Happy holidays to our listeners, and thanks for tuning in to the Living Permaculture Show on Public Radio KDNK. My name is Stephanie Sison, here with Jerome Ossentowski. Today is December 28th, 2016. We're just 1 week past the winter solstice, and slowly the light is returning to us. In celebration of the light, and to offer encouragement to all of our listeners that, like us, are already craving the tastes of summer, we have a treat for you on today's show. Local farmer and seedsman Casey Pascura of Wild Mountain Seeds is with us in the studio today. Wild Mountain Seeds is a high-elevation seed breeding and food production research farm located here in Carbondale. Today we'll be hearing details about his bountiful farm and the landowners who he has partnered with, as well as his passion bordering on obsession with tomato breeding for our harsh mountain climate. Our listeners may remember Casey from a previous show where we talked about the multiple problems with chemical weed control. Log on to KDNK's Public Affairs Archive to listen again. Welcome to the show, Casey.
Thanks for having me.
We would love for our listeners who don't know who you are for you to share a little bit about your company as well as what inspires you to do the work that you're doing right now.
So yeah, my company is Wild Mountain Seeds. We're located on the old Thompson Creek Ranch, known as Sunfire Ranch, owned by Alex and Jason Sewell and family. We grow mainly for market gardening, but with an emphasis on seed saving and creating our own varieties to cope with our short season, as well as developing good culinary and resilient varieties for a resilient future.
And what do you think was one of the, or a couple of the things that inspired you to do this?
Partially just feeling a bit vulnerable living in the mountains and also wanting to just have as much success with the seeds that I was given. So knowing that things are hard or we had a really small season, it just made sense to start completing the circle in growing, to keeping the seeds, trying to think about where all our fertility is coming from, and trying to not to make all our decisions based upon profitability if it's not sustainable.
Right. And so do you find when you first started growing things, and I know we've had you talk about tomatoes before, and they're just a classic example of things that people just moving here try to grow, and they go get their big boy tomato from your random box store, and then they try to grow it and they don't do very well, and then they think they're not a good gardener or that they can't grow tomatoes here. And so what do you have to say to them, and what encouragement might you have experienced over the years of collecting different kinds of seeds and adapting them for our climate?
Well, I guess one is a word of encouragement. I had a bunch of success with all kinds of different varieties. I've been able to source a lot of really interesting things coming out of the Siberia, or collections from people that are really interested in high-altitude tomato growing. We're also interested in high-altitude staple crops growing and other things, and tomatoes are just, I think, one of those that we all just love so much with their nutrient content, and it's a fun crop to work with because they're very easy to save seeds of, and you can quickly become a seed breeder of your own with little knowledge.
And you've also been experimenting with different beet greens and kales and selecting hardy varieties of that, and intercropping a lot of stuff with fava beans. And for our listeners, you can also see one of our Grow Up television series that we featured you in, and we might make that link for people who want to see what the farm looks like. And you've been using a lot of low-tech hoop houses and retrofitting what you need to make make things grow in a very pretty harsh environment there, right under Mount Soperus, where you're in a frost pocket. But you've been able to pull out it off with a lot of innovation and a small amount of funding.
Yeah, it's exciting and to look at what's possible, but also looking into what work needs to be done. vegetables and most of our crops are kind of a step away from trying to become more wild species. They don't necessarily want to continue to grow beets forever. The beets are what we selected as our relationship with the human to the plant. So there's some things that are challenges here. Let's say we want to create an early crop of beets in a cold environment. Well, all the beets sometimes become adults and they don't produce big bulbs. They'll just grow straight to seed. So we can start to plant out as lots of diversity of many different beets, subject them to that normal temperature that would make them adults, and find the ones that can give us our early crops. So we're looking into ways to improve both the genetics and the culture in the greenhouses to give us a nice long season that we can create a lot of food with.
Excellent. And so what are some of the things, or first, what are some of the crops that you're doing besides tomatoes that you're working with breeding right now?
Yeah, so we're really interested in getting into staple crop breeding from our cold legume species like fava beans, lentils, garbanzos, peas. Those are particularly important to us because they're soil builders. They fix nitrogen as well as their high protein sources for and make seeds that can be stored over a long period of time to get us through the winter. Focus, I think, will be as we become more resilient as a culture is to grow staples during the summer. Think about winter food during the summer and move a little bit away from the normal market garden where we're growing high turnover salads and things that don't really keep us alive in the winter.
Yeah, a lot of these intercropping beans and peas and favas are very nutritious. They're very easy to cook, and they're very nutrient-rich. They have the proteins that some of these other salad greens and the tomatoes don't have. So it really rounds out your diet, and also it's fixing nitrogen for the soil, and it's also creating fodder. You can compost that, lay it down as mulch, or you can turn it under. So it's a win-win situation, especially for new farmers who are trying build soils and not to bring in a lot of compost. They can actually grow their own compost with these intercropping legumes, right?
Yeah, legumes, and also with vigorous grasses like your corn or wheat or rye or things that we can use
barley
to make into a nice seed-to-end match for creating good compost.
I've been making barley grass out of some barley I got from just up the road here, getting more chlorophyll into my diet in the wintertime besides the kale and charge we grow. But just growing a dozen trays of barley grass and juicing those and then putting them in your smoothie in the morning is a good way to get a big punch. Then after you grow that out, I let it grow again and then just feed it to the rabbits and the chickens. So you know, there's so many simple ways of getting nutrient-rich food, chlorophyll, into your system, and that it's not that difficult.
And I'd love for you guys to unpack the word intercropping for our listeners who maybe aren't as familiar with the farming lingo and don't know what that is.
Yeah, so intercropping is basically where you're planting two different species of plants together in the same beds. So there is a lot of research into ways in which Native Americans grew their corn in combination with beans or in combination with squash that have beneficial relationships to each of those species, where the nitrogen being fixed by the bacteria on the roots of the legume are creating enough excess for the corn, where also the corn sugars on the roots are feeding the bacteria of the bean. So what I've found is there's a happy medium between putting too much together, knowing the timing. So if I want to put my beans with my corn, I know that I want to plant my beans when my corn's 4 inches tall so that it works all together and doesn't. So a lot of people get maybe discouraged on interplanting because they haven't gotten the full system down. But what's really awesome with from a soil building standpoint, we grew corn, squash, and beans together. If we find that soil is maybe a little bit lean, it needs to be built up, the beans dominate the growing usually. So the three sisters will kind of choose what the soil needs, also giving you what the human needs. So there was beds. We had 3 70-foot beds planted to corn, squash, and beans. And I think we probably ended up with about 50 pounds of fava beans off that bed.
Wow.
Another 50 pounds of corn, flour corn. And then another, I think, nearly 700 pounds of winter squash.
Wow.
So
that's a great.
Those are incredible yields, but it's good for a small startup because you can, not only that, we're creating a lot of roots. There's a lot of, the soil's not left barren. It's all covered in that stuff over winter. And we're still, I think, being pretty net positive on the soil building whilst creating a lot of staple crops.
And there's a lot of after harvest product that can go back into the soil after you harvest the fava beans and the squash, and so all that returns into it. The soil is mulch or redigested again. So that's one of the simplest combinations, and it's a good way to start way back in the beginning with corn, beans, and squash, and then expand from there.
Yeah, we've done all kinds of little stuff to maximize our space. Just now are we getting to where we have a bigger garden, so we're really trying to get the most per square foot. So being able to put, you know, some onions around the tomatoes or ways in which we can get another crop out of the same beds has been of benefit for our system.
I think it was very interesting the way that you commented on you can design these interplantings one way, but the soil and the plants really end up deciding what's needed the most. So you're really bringing that level of observation to notice if the beans are thriving, even though you did everything the same as in another bed, that there's something happening there where the beans are really needing to do some work in that space.
Yeah, seeing what's happening ecologically in the fields for the benefit of the soil that's there. And just picked up a new kind of idea if you're looking at a complete system where you're trying to breed microbes that want to create a good relationship with your crops, is when I'm harvesting and I notice this area really grew great, well, I can take some of that soil and put that on my compost and try to actually breed the microbes that are creating good beneficial relationships with the species. So we've started kind of picking up some tips from people that were telling me about that. I thought that was quite interesting.
Yeah, that's a great.
So another thing we're really breeding a lot is winter squash. I think winter squash is an incredible plant that we should all be growing, especially the Maxima varieties. They're very vigorous. They grow well in our short climate, create a huge amount of carbohydrates for the winter, and you can just store them in basically room temperature. That's how we're breeding them.
And they're fun to grow and easy to grow. We 2 years ago when we did winter squash up in our upper swales, they would find their way all the way up, halfway up a pinion tree, because you know there was just small amounts of annuals growing in the swales, but they had the whole pinion and juniper forest to kind of stretch out and trellis onto. One of the things you talked about with intercropping with like onions and tomatoes, there are some integrated pest management advantages of doing that in terms of, brassicas can help with some nematode problems. So you by mixing and matching, you can do some integrated pest management in addition to getting that extra crop.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's diversity is also a huge contributor there. We're putting in multiple crops, trying to get the spacing right so we're able to get production out of all of them. But then some of them, maybe they don't produce, they don't inhibit our main crop, the tomatoes, but they're serving the purpose of fumigating the soil from fungicides or keeping the late blight from happening or all the different varieties. Maybe you find that the aphids just like that one variety and they kind of leave the rest away. So every year we're kind of, it's usually a purple brassica that we're planting throughout the garden. And I think the one of choice is a open pollinated purple Brussels sprout. That is the aphid. All aphids love those. So they go there and they leave. Everybody's wondering, how's your kale so clean in the middle of the summer? Well,
because the aphids have their little corner
on the other.
Yeah. But just yesterday I pulled out a year and a half old clump of kale that's been growing in the south beds and was just totally infested with aphids. Well, the rest of the kale is pretty fine, but this was time to take that kale out. So I pulled it out and put it in a garbage can, took it to, fed it to the chickens yesterday when it was on Christmas Day. It was really dreary.
Merry Christmas, chickens.
And they had kale and aphids for lunch. And they were so happy. There was nothing left of it. I stripped off some of it, gave it to the rabbits. So I'd been there a year and a half. We'd had all the kale we needed off of that plant and time to cycle it back out.
Great. On that note, thanks for tuning in to the Living Permaculture Show on Public Radio KDNK. Before we get back to our show today, Jerome, you have some exciting updates for our listeners. Can you share them with us?
Well, we're having a lot of fun up at Crimpy, is keeping the fires going and shooting archery, doing saunas. And
Sounds rough.
I think, in my book I talk about, the arc, and I walk people through in that chapter of what you can do with a greenhouse and how you can have many, many different uses of it. And we're enjoying that this winter and probably get through most of the winter. And then we're off to do some traveling. I'm going to be doing talking at the EcoFarm Conference in Monterey. The conference has been going on for like 30 years now, and I'm a speaker there, and then do a few book signings around Berkeley and Stanford, perhaps. So that's going to be one trip we're doing at the end of January. And then in February, we're heading off to Cuba to meet with some permaculture designers and administrative people in the government of Cuba to set up an agroforestry school there as part of our carbon farming solutions agroforestry school. And we've done some workshops in Mexico. We're looking at setting up something in Cuba, Hawaii eventually, and maybe in Uruguay as well.
Are you trying to get away from the winter, Jerome?
Yeah, that's the whole idea is, I have a beautiful spot, and I go up on the mountain. A couple of days ago, I was up on Basalt Mountain, and I go up to my tree and commune and get exercise and go down to the, the greenhouse, shoot a few arrows and do my sauna and plant some beans. And
You've got some new fava beans from Casey
to plant
today.
Yes, we got some new fava beans, and I love planting favas in amongst the kale and in around anything. And sometimes I've coppiced them and laid them down. Usually the pollinators are a question, and I have to plant them a little bit late so that when they come up and start flowering, the doors are already open and my neighbor's bees are already down there. Jinder and Rob have bees, and I don't have bees, but I capture them in my greenhouse and
have them work for you.
Have them work for me before they go home. So we're looking forward to the fava beans. Eating fresh fava beans is one of the great joys of and in Italy. In February there's a special festival around fava beans.
Yeah, they're incredible. Plants, so vigorous, 5,000-year-old old bean species that can survive frost. It really,
and the nodulation on them is huge. When you look at the nodulation on another trip, we're another thing we're doing is working on our value added. We have our nursery up and going and doing green consulting and our education, but we're also doing a value added of for jams and seeds and teas and tinctures. We're going to be putting that into motion and working with the Farmers Union to set up a cooperative.
Great.
To structure all of our for-profit endeavors under the Crimpy umbrella, and then that'll kind of set up Crimpy to be more autonomous while I'm moving off into other directions and stuff.
Floating through the tropics. Mm-hmm.
And we have another call to do another book, and our working title is The Perennial Economy. So it's looking at farms as ecosystems and looking at sort of Crimpy of how it's modeled and how it's evolved into many different kinds of economic nuggets, sort of, that bring in income and also are sustainable and feed back into the mothership.
Great. That's all good news. We have about 5 minutes left, but I'd love to be able to touch on a topic that's really important for the Roaring Fork Valley. Whether farmers are starting out, expanding, or relocating, access to land is one of his or her biggest challenges. Young farmers in particular have difficulty purchasing farmland, and with few capital or other assets, young farmers typically can't afford the Roaring Fork Valley's high farmland prices. So Casey, I'd love to hear more about the relationship you have with the landowners that you're working with and the historic farmland that you're on right now.
Oh, we have an incredible relationship and some of the most supportive landowners you could ask for. I think there's actually a lot of opportunity for young farmers who are hard workers, reliable, and think that they can do it to look to some of these landowners who have what really creates resilience, which is historic water, protected water, and the land, and maybe a little bit of capital to help, one, the resilience of their farm, having more diversity of income streams, as also just, getting together with people that enjoy the process of raising animals or vegetables, and it's been really beneficial because we toss ideas back and forth, and it's really good. So I encourage anybody with land or if you are interested in a relationship to look towards our young farmers group locally. The Roaring Fork Farmers is a great place to find some people to help them get some land going.
Excellent. And there's, I don't know if you have specific information on this, but there is some new or relatively new tax credits for private landowners who lease for at least 3 years a parcel of their land to a beginning farmer, which would be anyone with less than 10 years of owning a farm.
Yeah, I'm not up on the speed of that as of now, but that's great. I mean, that's what we need. But just from being around and the more that I'm meeting ranchers and people with more land, is that there's a lot of open arms, but they're just waiting to get, I think, see more successful relationships. I know that Harper and Christian of Two Roots Farm have been working with the Spradley family of Mike Spade, and I mean, I was up there the other day, and they don't want them to ever leave. And these are relationships you develop because you're giving them value. You help them on multiple levels. And oftentimes, for us, it's right now basically a free arrangement, but we're improving the soil. We're helping them understand rotational grazing and helping them understand ecology a little bit more. And there's just some people that, same thing happening with Harper and Christian. So,
great. We're looking at a piece of land up on Basalt Mountain and talking with an owner to do something similar, to expand some additional agroforestry techniques up on Basalt Mountain. That used to be a lettuce-growing area up there on those meadows, and they used to ship lettuce to California.
Mm-hmm.
Private ownerships, open space land, whatever works. It'd be nice to see Carbondale rethink their Delaney property over here, and let's put that entire parcel into agriculture and put the dog run around the outside of it, bordered by some fruit trees and stuff. There's so many opportunities here. We need to start thinking, Michael, throw me with the perennial or the local food revolution. So we've got lots of opportunities to mix and match different legal and farming opportunities to get a lot more stuff growing right here in this valley.
So for our listeners who are interested in hooking up with a local farmer, if you are a local farmer or a local landowner, maybe just sign in to Crimpy's Facebook page and send us a note, and we'll see if we can get you connected to the right people. We are about out of time, Casey. I would love if you would offer our listeners some contact information for you if they want to reach out to buy things or learn more about any of the things that you're up to.
So, yeah, the best way to look us up is on our new website, wildmountainseeds.com. We'll have an online store up and running for purchasing locally grown seeds as well as sustainably sourced seeds. I'm trying to find, of what we don't grow, can I get it straight from the breeders of the best stock? So that just little tricks like knowing that Oregon has dry summers versus Maine's wet summers, just sourcing right seeds are really important as well. So they can buy seeds. Those any inquiries can be sent to wildmountainseeds@gmail.com, and we'll be offering a lot of new stuff this year.
Thanks, Casey, and thanks to our listeners. This was Living Permaculture on Public Radio KDNK. Happy holidays.